turns out what brings America together is a fear of death.
Amen.
It's very uniting.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Daruk. A slew of swing state polling has come out recently showing President Trump losing ground against presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden. Nationally, Americans' approval of Trump's response to the coronavirus crisis has also steadily ticked down. So today, we're going to consider how much of the narrative about Trump's handling of the pandemic is set and what could turn his fortunes around, potentially. Also, as states lay out their reopening plans and some take their first steps in actually reopening, we're going to ask how much of the response, both on the state level and among general voters, the general public, how much of the response to the crisis has tracked with partisanship. Here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, how's it going, Galen?
Going well, you know, going on 7 weeks in this work-from-home situation. Getting a little better in the technology department over time, although I would say not markedly so. But, you know, this is how we're doing it.
By the way, the people are like, this is going to permanently shift us to a digital economy, man. Like, f*** you, dude. Some things work good. Some things work well, and some things don't, right? But, like, I think this proves that there are a lot of shortfalls currently what we can do from home, and a lot of things that we miss about being able to do things in person, right? As many as there are things that have been good. It's nice there are more things you can get delivered than I realized. But, like, you know.
What are you getting delivered?
Okay.
Yeah, really?
Nothing exciting. Nothing exciting. No, I mean, now, could you get, like, liquor delivered in New York before? Or is that, like, a new thing?
Hell yeah.
You could always get liquor delivered in New York.
I never knew that. I always had to walk to the damn store.
Boomer.
All right. Anyway, we'll put this podcast in the category of things that we miss doing in person and can maybe not do quite as well remotely. And that brings us to, also with us, senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, Galen.
Hey. And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hey, Galen. Hey, everybody.
All right. So that was a fun way to start things off. But before we get to the public's latest marks for Trump, let's check back in on the arc of this crisis as we've been doing throughout this. So as of this taping, public counts of deaths in the U.S. due to COVID-19 are at about 50,000. Of course, we know those counts likely underestimate the true death toll. And Nate, last week we said on this podcast that we were still waiting to see whether coronavirus deaths themselves, not just cases, were past their peak nationally. So over the past week, how much data have we gotten to give us any indication of whether we're past the peak when it comes to those deaths?
We may be just a little bit past the peak, but I kind of also increasingly think that the peak is kind of not quite the right way to frame it. So if you look at, like, the average number of deaths over the previous 7 days, and the reason to do that is that there are all types of effects with respect to some states don't report very many fatalities on weekends and things like that, right? So a 7 day period is probably the best way to do it. Over the previous 7 days, as of last night, we were at 1,911 deaths per day. I mean, I want to, like, put that in perspective, right? That's like 2/3 of a September 11th event every day in the U.S. That is a little bit down from a peak of 2,041 on Tuesday of last week. So if you want to say we've gone from 2,000 to 1,900, okay, I guess if you're kind of engaged in an exercise to, you know, win a bet on when the peak is, then maybe the peak's gone down. But it hasn't gone down very much. There's reason to think that it'll be stubborn and slow, right? So you have, like, a long downward slope where a lot of people are still dying each day. It has fallen more sharply in New York, where in New York now we're now at less than half of the peak death count. We're in the mid-300s instead of the high 700s, I think. But the problem is there are other parts of the country where it's not clear that we've peaked in anything yet. And there are whole other issues about, like, we are now going back and counting deaths that occurred before that we maybe had missed before or had not correctly attributed to coronavirus. So that's the issue. You have 50 epidemics in 50 states, or maybe more properly, probably, you know, 100 epidemics, 100 metro areas or whatever, and they kind of all peak at different times. And New York is actually lots of reason to be optimistic about New York, at least, you know, having had a steeper decline. We can debate why that is. It may ironically be because so many people in New York had it that it's now a little bit harder to transmit in New York. So according to estimates Governor Cuomo put out this morning, about 25% of people, this is up actually from an earlier estimate, in New York City have antibodies to coronavirus, which may mean, and we can have a whole model talk, Galen, debating these studies and whether they're too high or too low. But it may mean, first approximation, about a quarter of New Yorkers had COVID at some point. If that's the case, then that meaningfully would make it harder to transmit, right? So it's kind of like, if you want to be New York or Lombardy, then you can have some effect from herd immunity, but it also means you have this terrible thing happen in between, and so it's not like the way you want to get there. And then nationally, we have something good happening. If you put aside moving us apart away from how many people are dying to the question of testing, right? Which is the number of tests has now increased a lot, where we're getting sometimes 250,000 tests a day or 300,000 tests a day, up from about 150,000 a week or two ago. So that's really good, because in any formulation of this, being able to do more testing will be key to eventually recovering. As a result of that, sometimes the number of cases will go up or go down, but the share of tests that are positive is declining. Again, that's a national average. It's declined a lot in New York. In New York City, it's declined from like almost 60% at the peak to around like 24% now. It's a big shift. In other places, it's more constant, right? So you see kind of an overlap of all these different curves. And on the whole, they are moderately positive. But it's really kind of a mix of the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut curve, which, as I explained before, is now fairly encouraging. And then everything else combined is meh. So that's kind of where we are.
All right. So that's the backdrop to, well, the politics that we'll be discussing during this episode. So thank you for that check-in, Nate. Good to get a sense of where we are in the crisis. But let's move on to how the public is viewing all of this from a political perspective at this point in time. And here's some of the recent data that we've gotten in. So in our approval tracker of Trump's handling of the coronavirus crisis, he's gone from slightly above water to now 4 points underwater. When it comes to his overall approval, he's lost almost all of his bounce and is back down to being 9 points underwater nationally. Last week, we also got a number of high-quality swing state polls showing Trump losing ground against Biden. Biden led by 8 points in a Fox News poll of Michigan and Pennsylvania. He led by 4 points in a Quinnipiac poll of Florida and by 3 points in a Marquette poll of Wisconsin. The New York Times and Politico and others have recently published pieces featuring Republican strategists who are increasingly nervous about the path that Trump is on. So let's discuss that path. We know that polls this far out from an election are not necessarily predictive. But Claire, how do you view these latest developments in terms of the track that Trump is on at this point?
Well, I think, the 538 caveat with all things is like, oh, it's 6 months out. Everything we're going to say in the next 20 minutes is moot. But I do think it's the confluence of a couple of things. I mean, one, it's sort of the silent but deadly to Trump Biden strategy, which is just like, let Trump be Trump. And Trump being Trump is sort of personified or embodied by, let's say, his press conference a couple days ago, where he crazily talked about, you know, shooting light and disinfectant into people. And so that sort of incompetence on a hugely public scale has been damaging to the president, I think. And, you know, we'll see what direction he goes on the heels of that really embarrassing press conference. Perhaps he'll be much, 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 much more careful or be speaking much less publicly, which I think would be good for him electorally. Which, you know, it's working for Joe Biden, right? I don't think this will actually happen, but think about what would happen if it was just a battle of the silent candidates. No one talking and sort of waiting to see what happens. But obviously you're seeing a huge, you know, dissatisfaction with those key kind of maybe softer Trump supporters where they've liked the president's approach on the economy, but the economy is in a deep K-hole and no one knows when it's going to rebound. So
you say the economy is in a K-hole?
Well, it is, isn't it? Isn't a recession or a depression? I know we don't know what we're in. Nothing if not the economic equivalent of a K-hole. I don't really know how long a K-hole will last, though. Maybe we'll have to come up with a different term. Anyway, so all this is to say, we're in a period of deep public dissatisfaction as, you know, people are realizing that this isn't just a thing that, quote unquote, ends by Easter. It's the next year or years of our lives, and Trump's response to it has been poor. I don't know. I mean, we can kick it off and talk about the different sort of slivers of constituencies that actually like Joe Biden. So,
yeah, there's a lot to untangle here. But just off the bat, Micah, how are you processing the recent data that we've gotten in terms of how the public either views Trump's response to coronavirus or how set it may be at this point?
I don't think it's set. Certainly, I think opinion about how Trump's handling the pandemic could change. I do think it's safe to say that the coronavirus and the economic fallout from it have probably moved the general election from, like, you know, maybe before all this, it was close to a 50-50 proposition to now you have to say, okay, Biden starting this race as a maybe slight favorite. Maybe you would just say favorite. I mean, the polling 6 months out is not determinative. There's plenty of time for it to change. It's not worthless either, though. And the polling, especially in the last month or so, is pretty consistent. Most swing state polls show movement towards Biden. Now, this could end up being a sort of nadir of Trump's reelection chances, right? If he can sort of rescue his response and the narrative around it. But, you know, that doesn't make it meaningless, right? You'd rather, at the end of the first quarter of a basketball game, you'd rather be up 5 points than down 5 points, even though there's plenty of time to play. One of the more interesting storylines, that our erstwhile friend Harry Enten had a piece suggesting, and he was very tentative about it, but, you know, he was looking at polling that maybe showed that, you know, Trump's electoral college advantage, in other words, Trump in 2016 and polls up until before the pandemic, showed Trump overperforming in battleground states relative to the nation overall. That's why he was able to win while losing the popular vote. And I think most people expected that advantage to remain in 2020. Harry was pointing to some evidence that at least tentatively suggested that maybe that advantage had lessened or disappeared because of coronavirus. Maybe older voters are especially dissatisfied with Trump's response. Those voters are disproportionately represented in those battleground states, and maybe that'll have an effect. I'm not saying that's real. We don't really know that yet, or that it'll persist. But it's a reminder that, you know, this pandemic has the potential to reshape the race, not only in who's ahead. I think it's done that, at least to date, but also in the contours of the coalitions, and even a marginal change in those contours could significantly affect, you know, Trump and Biden's chances.
Yeah, the older voter sliver, I think, is really interesting. And that's, you know, the fact that they're already inclined to be okay with Joe Biden, right? Joe Biden isn't super left wing. He's not super young. He's, you know, he's a familiar face. And then the whole idea that, you know, older people have kind of become this odd controversial target from, you know, let's say, like, some Fox News segments of the media, where people are saying, like, it's okay, you know, like, we should trade off some deaths in the elderly population for a more robust economic recovery. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable political dynamic to be experiencing in a general election year. I mean, you know, Florida, a lot of old people, you know, and you know, Florida has had some sort of controversial approaches to the coronavirus crisis in general. Like, if I were a Republican operative, aside from, let's say, the morality component of this, because we are talking about politics, like, just from a political point of view, you might be really worried about the way that right-wing media is spinning some of the economic recovery stuff.
Yeah, Claire, just to put a finer point on what you just said about Florida, in that Quinnipiac poll that I cited earlier on that showed Biden leading, Trump's lead amongst voters over the age of 65 is only 10 points. And in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, it was 17 points. considering that Florida is the second oldest state in the country, like, that's a big deal. Over 50% of voters are over the age of 50. Like, old people matter.
So I have a few different kind of complicated thoughts here, right?
All right, we're ready.
Okay. And these don't necessarily fit together that well. Just notes I've written to myself. Mental notes.
Oh, dear.
Number one, I'm going to stick with Memorial Day as a rough benchmark for when I want to start to pay a lot of attention to general election polls, or I should say even more than a little bit of attention, right? That would give us a bit more time to understand how this crisis is progressing. By the way, you know, I kind of was critical of people who, you know, last year or whatever was looking at, oh, here's all the Electoral College and how it lines up with the popular vote. The reason for that is, like, it requires a lot of precision to do that. And to some extent, having done this before, you kind of learn that often in the second half of the year. When we first launched our model in 2016 in June, it had Trump with a very slight Electoral College advantage that became more clear, though, once we got more polling in as the campaign evolved. So it could be that, like, you know, it looks like Biden's making gains and then he's not or whatever else. Number two is, I think a challenge for Trump is that there is kind of no scenario in which this goes away. The best case scenarios might involve something like, it turns out that summer weather helps and therefore we can relax things a little bit and it doesn't create too much more spread. And then by early fall, there are some effective therapies in place that cut down the death rate a fair bit. And it turns out that a lot of people had it. So therefore, in a few places, you actually have some effect from herd immunity. You know, okay, that's still going to lead to probably tens of thousands more Americans dying. It's still going to lead to an economy that has been profoundly affected by this and at best is just starting to recover by the fall, and probably still going to lead to some degree of abnormality until we actually get extremely effective treatments or a vaccine. So it's not going to go away to the point where it's great. It could be going away to the point where it seems okay, right? But the public's patience is wearing, I think, a bit thin with Trump. The third thing is, I do think that, like, you know, this debate about opening up and what that means, and I think we'll probably talk more about the partisan nature of this later. You know, I generally speaking, think people overdo the partisan nature of this. There are blue states like Colorado, I guess it's now blue and not purple, that have plans for opening up certain things this week, right? There are countries like Italy. Italy has a plan. Whether it will pull the plan off or not, we'll see, right? But how to reopen different things in stages. And so, on the one hand, clearly the polling right now shows people have a lot of patience with lockdowns. On the other hand, you know, what did people buy into? I think they bought into saying, we're going to be shut down for not just a few weeks, but probably shut down for a month or two. And then there'll be some plan for returning to normal, right? I don't know that people bought into indefinite lockdowns without a plan. And so either we kind of get those plans, or I think we get, we do begin to see more frustration from the public. And so I think that's like a little bit more of an open question, but Trump is not in great shape right now. And because the pain of this will be with us for a long time, again, even in relatively optimistic scenarios, we avoided all, it's too late now for any of the really optimistic scenarios, right? It's too late for us to turn into South Korea, too late for this to just go away. Probably way more people, by the way, have died from this than are officially recorded anyway, right? And so, like, the memory of this is not going to have faded by November, no matter what.
So, wait a second. Nate, you don't, and I this isn't me making a statement, it's a genuine question. You know, you've seen a lot. I mean, the White House, in terms of messaging, has actually kind of been all over the place in terms of economic messaging. But Mnuchin over the weekend, or maybe late last week, predicted a kind of V-shaped recovery where the country comes roaring back. Does that seem unlikely to you guys now?
Well, look, let's say you shut down 30% of the economy and that caused like a 30%. I guess annualized rate, drop in GDP. And then you turn half of it back on because things are somewhat better in the fall or by the summer. That would cause a pretty steep recovery from a very low baseline, but you're still way lower than what the baseline would have been, right? And so whether that's a V or a U or a Nike swoosh, right? But like, you're probably not going to see unemployment improve all that much, because guess what happens, right? Let's say you have to close your restaurant because you couldn't pay your rent because you had no customers for 3 months. That creates a disruption. Now, what's going to happen in the long run? In the long run, probably someone forms a new restaurant and they hire people back. That might happen a year from now. And so you're going to have a lot of disruption to like continuity of business operations.
Yeah, that's my big question, is like all of these small business administration loans. You know, there's some reporting out this weekend that like, well, actually, some of those loans were going to rather large companies rather than small businesses. You know, if you look around New York, there's a lot of these independently owned businesses that are operating on small margins that are closed for good. You see that all around the country. So I'm kind of, won't those effects happen for a couple of years to a certain big percentage of the country, even with all the supposed recovery help from the government?
I would think so. And I agree with what both you guys are saying in terms of like, to get back everything, to claw back everything that was lost will likely take years. But I just wonder if we've seen like so many times politics is about expectations. And so if we drop 30% and then gain back 15% or 10%, whatever, right? I guess I don't think the American people will look at it as, oh, we're still down 15%, we're still down 20%. I think people adjust to the new baseline and then look forward.
But I think, Micah, a lot of times it's hard to be that precise in terms of like, oh, we're back 15%, so Americans feel 15% better. Faith in the economy and feeling security in your job don't necessarily track with raw GDP numbers. I mean, a good example potentially of this is the 1992 election, where there was a recession earlier in the year that had a big impact on how George H.W. Bush was viewed by the general public. The country was out of the recession by the time Election Day rolled around, but Americans' faith in the economy and feeling of there being a recession hadn't shaken by then, because it takes a while for all of that to turn around and for Americans' feelings about the economy to get back on track.
I think that's right, but I think I would argue that inexactness and the kind of lack of a direct link between those two things, between people's feelings and actual economic activity, has the potential to work both ways. So it has the potential to lag, so you know the recovery could be happening and people still feel down in the dumps. But I also think it has the potential where if we are growing, people start to feel more optimistic and maybe they can get out ahead of what the actual recovery has been.
Are you sort of saying that Mnuchin promising a V-shaped recovery is sort of bad political expectation setting?
Oh yeah, that's definitely stupid. I mean, well, like, look, one statement by Mnuchin isn't going to like set expectations. That's part of my point, is the expectations probably matter here. Maybe they don't matter enough to overcome actual performance, but actually, Claire, that's exactly what I was going to say, is if the White House managed the politics of this well, maybe the lack of a direct relationship between public opinion and politics and actual economic performance would be more likely to work in their favor. But betting that the White House will manage that game well is probably a bad bet. So maybe that's an argument for what you guys are saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to just take Mnuchin as a potential, you know, signal from what the thinking is inside the White House writ large. And I think we kind of know from 4 years of the Trump administration that it's a group of people that tends to, at least in a public-facing format, deal in sort of absolutes. There's not a lot of nuance in the messaging. So it's either America is in a deep crevasse of we're being overrun with immigrants, blah, 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 to the stock market has never been higher. So to kind of thread that needle of what does a responsible and realistic economic recovery look like? That, I think, will be key to them over the next 6 months. It's something you're already seeing Republican strategists hand-wring over. And I do have trouble conceptualizing how you get anything other than we're in for a V-shaped recovery from the Trump administration.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what the Trump administration and Republicans writ large could do to try to redirect the president's fortunes from where they are now, which, as we've discussed, is not a good spot. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. During this time of change, ZipRecruiter's focus has not changed. They're still doing what they've always done, helping people find work and helping businesses find the right people for their open roles. If you're looking for a job, ZipRecruiter is working with you to find the right job faster. They are dedicated to helping you get hired, from caretaking to delivering food and goods to building medical facilities or supplying protective equipment and so much more. In fact, ZipRecruiter's app will send you up-to-date job openings so you can be one of the first to apply. And if you're actively hiring, ZipRecruiter will invite candidates to apply to your most urgent roles, making it faster and easier to reach the people you need. By connecting people who need jobs and companies that need people, ZipRecruiter is helping people work together. You can find out more at ZipRecruiter.com/work together. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/work together. We're back, and as we've discussed, the president's polling in swing states has declined a bit. Also, the economy is not where he imagined it would be when I think he and Republicans were planning the campaign that they would wage in 2020. And so given all of that, the question is, how could President Trump and Republicans writ large kind of turn their fortunes around, whether it's based on the economy and setting expectations or pivoting messaging altogether? What's the winning message now that it isn't, you know, record low unemployment and record high stock markets?
So there was some reporting in various outlets that the National Republican Party is advising GOP candidates to basically lean into an anti-China message, essentially to redirect people's displeasure towards China. That's the basic gambit politically. I don't necessarily have a strong opinion on how likely that is to work. It does strike me as a more of a base play than a general voter play. I think it's more likely to work with people who are already in Trump's camp and people who are already voting for Republican Senate candidates, for example. But that's their answer to your question, Galen, at least reportedly.
They've been doing it for a while, though. I mean, we've talked about it on this podcast. Trump was calling it the Chinese virus a month ago. You know, and to me, it's kind of like if you're like up shit creek in a leaky canoe, what do you do, right? Like, you can't, I mean, probably other Republicans can't responsibly promise an immediate return of the stock market to historic highs in 3 months. So it's not the message I think a lot of them wanted to run on. Maybe Trump doesn't have a particular problem with it, but it is kind of like, from a strategy point of view in the GOP, what kind of worked for us in 2016 was a direction of a certain amount of anger onto, you know, immigrants. And I think China is a slightly different thing because it is, there are certainly, I think you could say, xenophobic elements to it. You know, calling it the Chinese virus obviously, you know, led to racialized attacks in the U.S., all that stuff. But China has also probably been fudging the numbers a little bit, or not releasing information, or sowing disinformation campaigns in the United States. So it's a more nuanced thing, I think, for the public. And it's one of those things where, as the next 6 months go on and as we figure out what was happening 3 months ago, you might see the American public shift a bit in their thinking, or different slivers of the American public.
Yeah, I think in some ways, the things that might give Trump the best chance are the things he probably will least like to do, right? I mean, the scenario Micah outlined earlier about people are feeling optimistic about the recovery, maybe because expectations were so low, and there's a sense of renewal and kind of pride in the community, right? You know, that's a scenario you can imagine people becoming more empathetic. Trump did get this small bounce early on in his approval ratings that has since worn off. A lot of incumbents in other countries got bigger bounces, but maybe it turns out Trump actually did listen to the experts after all. I mean, there are some reasons why, you know, American healthcare companies and pharmaceutical companies are very innovative, right? So we might if their effective therapies get them sooner than other countries might, right? So maybe there's optimism about that and our ingenuity and whatever else, right? But that requires them, I think, not to like point a lot of fingers, not to try to blame China too much, although Claire is right that there are many, many, many things we can criticize about the Chinese government's response to COVID-19. But like, that's the whole fantasy of today was the day Trump became president that I think is very unlikely to actually occur.
The other thing I think I would bet on, and that I'll be really interested to see, if we do start to recover before the election, and that's still an if probably, right? Whether it's a V or a U or, as Nate said, a Nike swoosh, my bet would be that Trump and the White House will lean full throttle, all in on selling that recovery. In other words, they won't do. Remember during the Obama administration when we were recovering from the Great Recession, but it was uneven and it was slow, and they were, the Obama White House was like racked by guilt and unease and anxiety about calling it a recovery and selling that. I would bet my house that the Trump administration will not suffer similar anxiety, and they'll just be like, we're recovering, great. And that might work better than at least what Obama did. Although Obama won re-election, so who knows?
Although it's tricky, it's because all three of these things are likely to be going on to some degree, right? Either you yourself are out of work, or your hours are cut, your pay has been cut, and or you see very visible damage in your community. It seems like it's been easier for big businesses to get bailouts than small businesses. And maybe to some extent, if you see the shops and restaurants and whatever that you're empathetic toward that are now not open, that's more visible, right? And number three is, again, like, I don't think we're going to be completely back to normal by November. In the optimistic scenarios, we might be 80% back to normal, but there's still going to be a lot of things that people are not able to do, a lot of anxieties people have, a lot of weird kind of uncanny valley things that are not quite right. And like, so it's like not going to be easy to like kind of put this out of your mind, is I guess what I'm saying, by November.
Here's my question about, you know, I've been thinking about the uneven recovery of 2008 and the way it affected certain states that we have seen in the past decade be key to determining margins of victory. And so I'm kind of curious if you think that this, if you guys think that the economic crisis puts certain states that we had all but written off as solid red ones back into the, it could go either way category. Obviously, I have an Ohio bias, so I'm kind of thinking about whether or not that is a state that's you know, it's inclined to like Biden a certain amount. Trump is really struggling with the economic portion. You know, I don't know, somewhere like Iowa. Like, I'm just curious if you guys think that those states are back up in play, or if that's A, too early, and B, maybe that's like a bit too hard to tell.
There are different things here. First of all, if Biden is up by like 8 points nationally, which some polls have him up by that much, then he could win states like Ohio and Georgia and Iowa that he might not otherwise, right? So in a landslide, a lot of states become competitive. But are they tipping point states, as we call them? I don't know. But no, I think, Claire, you're totally right that like there are going to be very idiosyncratic economic effects and effects of the disease itself that affect some states much more than others. Also, governors have different responses to them. And people may compare and contrast Trump's response to the governor's response in different ways. So, yeah, it introduces a lot more, I was going to say randomness. It's not quite the right word, but it introduces a lot more uncertainty and idiosyncrasy into the map. And I'm already someone in general who's like, okay, all you people who think it's just kind of five swing states, that's not what the models actually would show, the well-designed models. It was not the case in 2016, right? If you tried to pinpoint three states, right, you wind up with different states mattering. So no, it definitely calls for like an expanded list of battleground states, I think.
To you think of like, you know, Michigan and Ohio in the 2012 election, where a lot of people felt like, you know, the auto bailout in the wake of the Great Recession helped Obama win those states. Yeah, to Claire's point, could we see something similar where working for Trump or against him, where, you know, Trump working with a governor either really bungles or really nails aid to a particular state or guidelines that affect a particular state more than others, does have the potential, as Nate says, to like scramble the ordering of the states at least a little, which could have an effect, you know?
I mean, one thing to consider here as well when we're looking at these Biden versus Trump general election polls is that Biden has been very silent over the past couple months. And, you know, the Trump campaign and presidency has been more focused on coronavirus than trying to kind of characterize Biden for the public. So I guess one question would be, how much of these recent improvements for Trump are the fact that there's kind of a faceless generic Democrat running against him almost, as opposed to a person with faults and reasons to criticize and whatever that are going to be emphasized between now and election day? And one more thing I wanted to add to that is it seems like there's some push to tie Joe Biden to China and make Beijing Biden, that nickname, part of that attack. And you mentioned earlier that there's all kinds of reasons to criticize the Chinese government. And the polling makes it really clear that that is a bipartisan belief. Only 34% of Democrats say that they thought the Chinese government was a reliable source of data on here. You know, 67% of Democrats said that they thought the Chinese government had some responsibility in spreading the coronavirus. And like, even I think 40% of Democrats said that they thought that China should pay for the damage that the coronavirus has caused. So that seems like a pretty bipartisan, at least right now, point of view. So once the kind of attack arm of the campaign becomes stronger and Biden becomes potentially more center stage in this campaign, how does that change things?
I think it could change things in a couple ways. I'm not sure I buy much that like that they can make Beijing Biden stick or anything like that. I don't think that there's much like fertile soil there. I do think that Biden isn't a particularly great campaigner, and therefore it at the very least doesn't hurt him and maybe helps him when he can just largely remain silent. And then simultaneously, you know, we saw this during 2016, Trump tended to decline in the polls when he was the focus of media coverage, when he got more media coverage. I think we're seeing something similar now where Trump is in the spotlight every day and he doesn't acquit himself super well. So if we ever get to a point, which we might not, but if we ever get to a point where they are both, you know, under in the spotlight roughly equally, then I do think that at the margin will help Trump. Yeah.
You guys agree?
I don't know, Galen. I think some of that narrative is a little bit dubious about Biden having disappeared. And I think people, like, a lot of things haven't stuck to Biden. He's been...
Wait, why is that dubious?
Why is that dubious, Nate? He's not... I mean, to political reporters and to people who are on Twitter all the time, you see, yeah, you see him making statements and stuff, but what's the average American voter seeing of Joe Biden lately? Not much.
What kind of numbers are the Biden podcasts getting? Anybody know?
I listened to one episode, the one with Gretchen Whitmer. I have to say, not the best produced podcast I had ever heard.
Oh. If it's not called Riding with Biden, they are not doing things right.
No, but Nate, you're right. I think
what's the evidence that he is disappearing? Like, what do you mean? That's just an assertion without any evidence. What's he supposed to be doing?
No, it's not just an assertion. Literally, our former colleague Harry Enten looked into this and saw that mentions of Trump in national media were 9-1 over Biden.
That's because he's president in the midst of a national emergency. It's not because Biden is hiding.
Yeah, of course.
It's not because he's hiding, but nonetheless, he is hidden.
Hiding Biden.
The new podcast is Hiding with Biden.
No, and Nate, your question of what is he supposed to do Yeah, I don't think anyone's like blaming Biden for disappearing. Yeah. I think it's just the nature of the story. And what is he supposed to do? Again, if I were him, I wouldn't do anything. I would just kind of chill. Sure, release a podcast that not many people will listen to. And you know, wait for your kind of more stage managed parts of the campaign.
It's smart.
Yeah, the question is not like, is he hiding? The question is, is it an asset that he hasn't been talked about in the national press? And could things worsen for him once this stage of the crisis is over and he becomes more of a focal point again?
I don't think it hurts him. I mean, the one thing I struggle with as far as like what the, you know, what the criticisms could be once sort of the worst of all of this is over is, you know, Obama talked a lot during the transition, or people around Obama talked a lot about his worry that, you know, you not confuse the American public about who's in control. Like, you know, the president is, you know, needs to be in charge of the national emergency, blah, blah, blah. This is obviously different because it's about messaging. But I think, you know, if the Biden campaign were like, we're doing shadow health briefings that we're really going to try to make go mainstream in the media and like be everywhere, would people then be like, hey, why are you trying to undermine, you know, Fauci? Why are you trying to undermine the White House's message, you know, Trump aside? I don't know. It's sort of this weird, what advantage do they have to kind of getting up there and saying, like, we're going to be campaigning in the middle of this national, the peak of this national crisis? It's just, you know, we'll see. I'm sure the Trump campaign will make that a huge part of its, of the general election campaign. It's like, where was Joe when all of this was happening? Trump was out in front. But, you know, Trump's not doing a great job out in front. So why risk, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, this would change, right? If Trump were really nailing the response, then there would be an incentive for the Biden campaign to try to break into the message. That's not happening. So, yeah, you know, I think this is a solution in search of a problem, basically, from the Biden campaign's perspective.
Presumably, we will move past this point, at least in the equation of who gets the most, or like overwhelmingly the most press coverage, I think. Like, is there a situation in which we get to October and Biden has been in the background of this entire time?
Maybe.
I think the conventions and the debates, right? Those are the moments when Biden would structurally come to the fore. Outside of that, it depends totally on the pandemic, doesn't it?
I don't think there's going to be a convention or a convention of the kind that we're used to. Yeah, in which case, like, I'd be kind of curious to see if the traditional bounce applies, or if the traditional media saturation applies. I mean, the debates for sure, right? Like, that'll, you know, I don't know. I'm not being very eloquent about this. It's all just kind of like large question mark in bold.
Well, in that case, let's move on to our final segment and talk about how much partisanship is playing into responses to the coronavirus crisis, meaning in terms of both the public and politicians. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Casper. Years of research, hundreds of tests, thousands of iterations. The result? The latest and dreamiest in sleep innovation. Introducing the new mattresses from Casper. Casper has done it again with all new mattresses. Waking up with back pain? Introducing zoned support. Casper's unique ergonomic system designed to keep your spine aligned when you sleep. There's something brand new called Airscape, engineered foam layers with perforations that help regulate your sleep temperature. From bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything to build the dream bedroom for every kind of sleeper. And as always, free shipping and free returns. And now, Casper's also offering free contactless delivery. Go to Casper.com and use code 538, the numbers, not the letters, for $100 off your mattress order. That's code 538 for $100 off your mattress order. Terms and conditions apply. See Casper.com/terms. We're back, and last week we discussed the shutdown protests and how they did not necessarily reflect a majority view among Republicans, much less the American public. But there's been plenty of talk about whether partisanship has influenced people's reactions to the spread of COVID-19 overall. Are Republicans and Democrats following guidelines at the same rates? Are Republican and Democratic governors reopening around the same time? So let's wade into that question. What evidence do we have? Like, maybe let's start with people as opposed to politicians. Do we have any evidence that Democrats and Republicans as people are following guidelines or viewing the seriousness of this pandemic in different terms?
I think there is difference in attitudes about it, whereas where Republicans are more likely to say that they're not as worried about coronavirus, and they're more likely to say they worry about remaining closed too long than opening up too early. Do you actually see differences in behavior? I think that's much less clear. People have largely complied with social distancing. These protests are quite small and not necessarily reflective of broader public opinion. So you have kind of signaling when you ask people to express a political attitude in polls that I think may not fully correspond to people's actual behavior or even necessarily their actual attitude, because this can go both ways, right? You know, it wouldn't shock me if there are some Republicans who are like, well, I don't know if opening up seems like a great idea, but Trump seems to want to do it, and I'm going to say yes to this pollster. I think there might also be Democrats who are like, you know what, I thought this was going to happen a few weeks, but I'm not so ready for this continuing indefinitely. I'd like to reopen, but you know what, it seems like all of my friends and the liberal consensus on this side, so I'll say it's a bad idea to reopen. I mean, I think partisanship can kind of affect both sides of that debate. And if you kind of look toward Europe or other countries where they are making plans to reopen, right? I don't know what the politics are like within Italy or something. But the notion that somehow this has been mapped on to Republicans are pro-reopening, Democrats are opposed to it, there's no real reason why you should have a strong partisan split on that issue, apart from the fact that everything is partisan in this country.
It is so interesting, because I agree with Nate's description of it, which is if you look at – just look at survey data. So this is just what people are saying to pollsters, right? There is a meaningful split when you ask people for their views on the pandemic and how to respond to it. So certainly when you ask, you know, how's Trump doing? How are governments doing? Stuff like that. How serious do you think the pandemic is? Questions like that. There's a very clear partisan split. There is a much, much smaller partisan split when you ask people how they're behaving in response to coronavirus, which I think is just a very useful reminder that people do answer these polls with, you know, a lot of people answer them in a meta sort of way. There's some calculation going on, which is what is the pro-Trump response here? What is the pro-Republican, pro-Democratic response here? And let me give that. From the election's point of view, the question then becomes like, which matters, right? In other words, if people are still willing to align their answer with what they view as what their partisan response is supposed to be, even if they're behaving differently, which matters? Does it matter how they behave, or does it matter what they say when you're trying to predict how they'll vote in an election? I'm not sure we know the answer to that.
That's a good question. And I just want to add one data point to what you just said that jumped out at me when looking through some of the polling, trying to find an answer to this question. The Washington Post asked, at any time in the past week, did you wear a mask or face covering over your nose and mouth when going out in public? The percent who said yes among Democrats had worn a face covering in public, 69%. Republicans who said yes, 61%. Independents who said yes, 65%. Right? That means across Republican, Democrat, Independent, people are not really changing their behavior all that much as to whether they're wearing a face mask when they go out in public.
Yeah, and if anything, you would think that those small differences are caused by urbanization also, right? You probably need a mask more in New York City than in a low-density exurb. So yeah, people's behavior. And that could change, right? But I just think that, like, more than most issues I can think of, you may hear a disconnect between people's behavior, between their actual desires and uncertainties and fears, and their expressed preferences. So I think be careful on the polling on on all of these whole constellation of issues.
Turns out what brings America together is a fear of death.
Amen.
It's very uniting.
All right. So beyond the public that we have some kind of clear data on, or, you know, at least how they respond to polls and how they behave, what about governments? Now that we see state governments beginning to lay out their reopening plans, and some even actually reopen kind of as we speak in little pieces, is there a clear difference in how Democratic governors or Republican governors are charting that path forward?
Yes, but I think is the answer, right? Yes, there is a clear partisan difference. All else being equal, Republican elected leaders seem to be leaning more towards reopening parts of the economy. All else being equal, Democratic elected leaders seem to be leaning towards waiting and imposing restrictions for longer. But in most of the country, all else isn't equal, right? So it becomes really hard to kind of suss out why elected leaders are doing what they're doing. You know, at the top of the show, what Nate was saying about, you know, the virus peaking in different parts of the country in different ways, that's true, which makes some of these decisions to reopen parts of the economy questionable. The other part, though, is, and I'm just repeating what I've read here, which seems to make sense to me, but a lot of what public health officials are saying is, hey, it not only matters where the virus is in its curve in terms of reopening parts of your economy, it matters what are your testing capabilities and what are your contact tracing capabilities. In other words, let's say you reopen, you know, I'm the governor of Micatopia, which is the 52nd state of the union. Obviously, it's a utopia in most regards. But I shut it down for coronavirus. And now I'm like, okay, time to reopen. What happens if there's a second wave? How do I know that? How early can I identify that? And that's a real fear in opening back up, right? If you have like total testing capabilities, total contact tracing capabilities, then at least at the very least, and you see this in other countries, you can respond much more nimbly to the virus. So factoring in that, right, then I think a lot of these decisions, it's very tempting to then say, okay, something partisan is going on here. There, you know, both ways too. Sorry, I'll stop rambling, but a lot of like, you have to wonder whether some of these Democratic mayors, for example, are at the very least erring on the side of holding restrictions in longer because that's the party line, you know?
I think when you begin to see some states and some countries reopen, then the states that held out longer will look at those. And if they seem to be going okay, then there'll be very strong pressure on them to reopen. And if it's not, then they'll have lots of excuses to remain closed. I do think that like this whole conversation, not this whole conversation between us, but I mean the whole conversation in the world right now, is a little bit overly binary between closure and reopening and to some extent suppression versus mitigation is a bit ambiguous what's being pursued in practice, right? Where suppression means you're trying to actually keep the number of cases down. Mitigation means you're trying to flatten the curve in the way that expression was originally used and limit the damage. My guess is that you'll see a lot of places where the number of new cases, whatever it happens to be when restrictions are lifted, will be fairly flat over time. That people will be willing to say, okay, well, we're willing to kind of keep the same constant number. Doesn't seem to be overwhelming hospitals. And they'll kind of open up just enough and loosen things up just enough to where R, which is the reproduction number that we've talked about, is somewhere in the vicinity of 1. That will probably mean that a lot of things are still closed. But I don't know that we'll necessarily see like huge spikes because number one, many things will remain closed. Number two, other things that are open, like restaurants in some states, or nail salons, or barbers, there are a lot more protocols put in place. And number three, a lot of people will not avail themselves of those services anyway. And number four, there'll be things like mask wearing that help knock things down, and maybe weather, depending on what effect weather that has, right? So I'm not sure you're going to see like big, gigantic spikes so much as like persistent, very flat plateaus for long periods of time that ebb and flow and get a little bit better and a little bit worse, right? And I don't know how people will deal with that. But that might be, you know, but we're not going back to normal. Instead of reopening, we might be going 10% of the way back to normal for all the reasons I mentioned before. It's more incremental than I think people might acknowledge.
We'll keep tracking all of these things, and I think that's it for now. So thanks, everybody. Thanks, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thanks, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, everybody. Have a good day.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.